From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome. I'm Larry Mantle. You're listening to Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson from the classic film The Graduate. The movie was written by the great Buck Henry, who we lost earlier this week. We'll remember his career coming up on Film Week. Our critics also review the week's new movies, including Like a Boss, the comedy starring Tiffany Haddish and Rose Byrne. The horror movie Underwater stars Kristen Stewart, and the drama Three Christ pairs Richard Gere and Peter Dinklage. We'll get underway with Film Week right after NPR News. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. What a pleasure to have you with us. So many movies this week to talk about. We'll also talk about actors and their political pronouncements, which were derided by comedian Ricky Gervais at the Golden Globes. We'll get into that a little bit later on. I'm joined this week by film critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. Tim Cogshell is film critic for Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Charles Solomon, Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine film critic. We begin this week with the action horror film Underwater, directed by William Eubank. The movie stars Kristen Stewart, T.J. Miller, Vincent Cassell, and Jessica Henwick. It's the story of a group of aquatic researchers who must get themselves to safety after an earthquake rocks their subterranean lab.
We have about 30 minutes till meltdown.
Okay, guys, listen. The escape pods are gone, and the sub is out of order. And we're not getting any more radio signals. And the structure of the Kepler is totally unsound.
Captain, there better be a good punchline, because the setup is...
so weak.
Weak.
We go for the Roebuck.
The Roebuck?
It's a mile down and a mile that way. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
How would we even get there?
We walk.
Underwater is written by Brian Duffield and Adam Kozad. Christy, what'd you think?
This is a lean, mean, totally derivative B-movie sci-fi piece of schlock, but it's fun. It knows what it is. It does what it has to do quickly, maybe a little too quickly. I kind of wish they'd taken their time and like built their tension and at least established some semblance of like characters. Like, you don't know who anybody's name is when this thing happens. They just dump you right in the middle of it. But it's fun, you know? It's super derivative. It is Alien in the ocean. And so, but based on that formula, you know what's going to happen. You have this ragtag team of disparate scientists, and they're all super attractive, and you know that one by one, you know, they're not all going to make it. Spoiler, they're not all going to make it, and it's a matter of how gnarly it is when whatever is happening takes them out. Kristen Stewart is eminently overqualified for this, but just seeing her like running around in her bra and panties, like kicking butt underwater and crawling into small spaces, and it's fun. Although
she's Sigourney Weaver,
she absolutely is. Like, they're not
channeling.
They're not even trying to do anything different with that. She's really tough and she's stoic. The problem is though, because a lot of it takes place underwater, 6 feet down. They're in the Mariana Trench. Six miles down, rather. It's farther than that. It's really murky a lot of the time and hard to discern what is happening. And
I'm not sure.
Well, no, it's not good because I want to know. And maybe part of it is like they're trying to put you in those helmets and in those clunky underwater boots, and they want to make you feel the confusion and the fear that all these characters feel. They have to turn off their little flashlights that are attached to their helmet sometimes. And so they truly are submerged in absolute darkness quite often. But it makes it hard to follow at times.
Yeah,
still,
I
had fun.
You don't need to follow this.
So,
Tim,
does
the brother get hit the first thing?
it's a little joke that we talk, and you can watch the trailer. Everybody, the brother's not going to make it. And certainly, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, no way they're going to kill this brother first, right? You know, look, I'm not going to spoil anything, but I don't think I actually really have to. But that in itself was funny because they were even poking at us. Yo, you think we won't kill this brother? You think we won't? Miss Stewart continues to be just the most fabulous thing in Hollywood so far as I am concerned. She is 100% into this. She knows what they're doing. She's like, you want to make an underwater horror movie, do you? Okay, let's do it. And then she just pulls the ripcord and goes for it. She's running around. And yes, that's a homage to Sigourney Weaver in Alien 1979. This is Alien, as Christy said, though. It's not Alien.
The first one.
This is the first one, yep. Not the second one. That's a combat military movie. The first movie was a thriller horror movie. And that's what this is. And yeah, I like that it's dark and murky and we don't ever really see much of anything. Because if I got the feeling if we ever really saw any of this stuff, we'd be like, what the hell is that? But no, they just don't even go there. And I do, you're right, it's quite elliptical. They will cut simply to an entirely different section of the movie. You know, there'll be this sort of thing happening. The music will come up, it'll swell up, and we'll be someplace else entirely in the movie. They're like, doesn't make any difference what happened. We're going to pick it up from here. And then they keep going. I love it. Love Cassell.
Loved it.
I loved it. Wow. I had a really, really good time in this movie. And then like 87 minutes later, it's over. And that's just fantastic. That's what I'm talking about. That's the way you do this.
Is this an indictment, do you think, of like people messing with nature and just drilling out of greed? Or is this just like, go have fun with your escapism under the sea?
There's that little message. They keep saying, we've been drilling, they're drilling 7 miles down. And this is just this whole facility of all of these complexes all over. And they have to walk out. And somebody, they keep saying, you know, we're drilling down here and we have absolutely no idea what's down here. Well, they find out what's happening.
And even that's kind of a homage, isn't it, to the late 50s radiation sci-fi monster films where nuclear... Yeah.
Starting with Gojira and Rodan and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
All right. The film is Underwater. William Eubank, the director, Kristen Stewart stars. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. The comedy Like a Boss, directed by Miguel Arteta, lifelong friends Mia and Mel, played by Tiffany Haddish and Rose Byrne, start a cosmetics company together. Financial troubles hit. Their friendship is tested as they're offered a big buyout by cosmetics tycoon Claire Luna, played by Salma Hayek.
I need you to be fierce yourself so that you can inspire the ugly people to buy themselves into gorgeousness. Listen to the word. Fierce. Fierce. What is it saying to you?
I hear fear, then erst.
I hear that too.
Fierce. Now whisper it. Feel it. Jarring, unexpected, exhilarating. That's fierce. Can you be fierce?
Uh-huh.
Yes, we can certainly try.
Like a Boss, the film written by Adam Cole Kelly and Sam Pittman. Tim?
She had a vase with a golf club that she's walking around with in this movie, Salma Hayek. That's what happens there in that clip. And it isn't funny in the clip, hearing it. It isn't funny in the movie, seeing it. It's odd how a movie that has so many sort of interesting turns of phrase and such a quick wit, Tiffany Haddish, kind of a quick wit there, can in and of itself not be funny at all. I'm like, how can these people be saying all these funny things, yet this movie isn't funny at all? And it walks right down this path of like a 1988 sort of comedy constructed in this particular way. And no, it just doesn't work. They're friends from middle school, Tiffany in Rose Byrne's character. Look, this casting. Really? What made people think that these two, you had, there's no chemistry at all. It's like they actually don't even like each other in this movie. And some of that is constructed. You have Salma Hayek's character, the powerful owner of this big firm who wants to take over the company. She's going to drive a wedge between their friendship and break them apart. And she's very sly about the way she starts to do these things. But no, not at all.
Like a Boss, Christy.
This is a movie written and directed by men that in no way resembles the way women actually relate to each other. Nothing about that friendship between Tiffany Haddish and Rose Byrne ever makes sense. And it's just the lack of what is on the page. I suspect that maybe they just figured that Tiffany Haddish would show up and be funny. You know, and Rose Byrne has a wide array of comedy that she can do. She can be the straight woman. She can go to wild, crazy places. She can do all of that. And I wonder how much of it was that they just figured, okay, they're going to show up and that alone will be enough. Speaking of wasting talent, like Jennifer Coolidge and Billy Porter get nothing to do but stand there and make sassy wisecracks and, you know, grimace and reaction to stuff. There's exactly one moment that I laughed in, and it involves Billy Porter. He gets this very showy moment to himself, and it's like, oh, it feels so good to laugh. Finally. But like the Selma Hayek character, I mean, I realize she's intentionally super over the top, but the idea of this movie, the whole fundamental premise of this movie of women tearing each other apart for sport or out of spite seems so totally out of touch. And then it tries to do this 180 of women looking out for each other, and makeup's all about how your best friend makes you feel when you're standing beside her, and look at how great her skin glows. And like, they try so hard to have it both ways. And it's this super raunchy R-rated comedy.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's offensive. It's really, really not. It's just it's awkward in the ways they try to shock us involving like stuff with body stuff
and sex
and they smoke pot in front of a baby. I mean, it's trying so hard to shock us with that R rating. It's just, and it's slapped together. Like the things that define these characters make no sense. That the big climax at the end where they're crying and hugging, the stuff they're apologizing for, like, who is that character?
And this
character
is Miguel did Star Maps, Chuck and Buck. The Good Girl.
That's 20 years ago.
Yeah, I guess
that was all good 20 years ago.
Writers of those, Mike White did many of those.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so,
Like a Boss, directed by Miguel Arteta, Adam Cole Kelly, and Sam Pittman, writing the screenplay here. Tiffany Haddish, Rose Byrne, Salma Hayek star. It's rated R in wide release. The Japanese animated film from writer-director Makoto Shinkai is Weathering With You. Charles?
Well, remember we talked last week about how the last decade in Japanese animation has been one of a passing of the baton, and Shinkai is one of the new directors who's really making an impact both artistically and even financially in animation there. And this was one of my favorite films of last year. You have Hodaka, a young teenager who runs away to Tokyo from his island home. He meets a girl named Hina, who he discovers has this quality, this power out of legend. Tokyo is in a perpetual deluge to the point where the reclaimed land is being swallowed by the old Edo Bay. The landfill islands are sinking, and she is a weather girl. She can pray to the sun, and it will appear and break the clouds for a short time. And so they begin to exploit this and become involved with each other. It's very much tying into the ethos of the young people in Japan who feel excluded by the post-bubble economy. There are more and more young people who simply don't see a future for themselves, either in business or being able to marry. And it's also speaking to the very real concerns. Japan is a country that is, you know, racked by natural disasters. There are earthquakes, there are tsunamis, there are typhoons, and there had been a really vicious typhoon around the time this opened in Tokyo, and I was teasing Shinkai about that he planned it that way, but they also feel that they are not going to be able to continue on this deteriorating, heating planet that their irresponsible elders have left them. And it ties into all of that in this sort of rom-com in some ways. While it's not as good as Your Name, that's a really, really high bar. I think it's a very interesting film, a very complex one from a very interesting filmmaker.
We're talking about Weathering With You, Christy.
It's extremely beautiful in very delicate ways, like bold colors, but also what they do, because so much of it has to do with water.
Yes.
Which is clear. And then there are like umbrellas and there are things that are clear, and the kind of contouring and the sort of the light through these drops of water as a prism. It's quite beautiful and delicate, and it seems like it would be hard to achieve that and do it with like structure, but also sort of an ethereal quality. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous film, but the sunshine girl, the weather girl, is kind of like a manic pixie dream girl. She's kind of a trope. I mean, she flits about and she's silly and she's unexpected and she can just close her eyes and the sunshine comes out. Literally, the sun comes out. And so she's kind of an idea, sort of a collection of ticks, of quirks, of character quirks. But it's a very, very beautiful film. And there's also going to be, there's an English language dub of it that is coming out this weekend as well, with Riz Ahmed and Alison Brie among the cast.
Weathering with you, Tim.
Yeah, relatively speaking, in service of these sort of male characters, these sort of manic pixie sort of things. It is ridiculously beautiful. The weather is the thing here. That opening sequence is almost worth the entire film. He's on this a boat, and a storm hits, and he almost falls off the boat, and he's saved. Almost washed off the boat, and he's saved. It's absolutely thrilling. Absolutely, a little bit scary, though, for little kids, I think. And then it all sort of builds out from there. Very, very good. I liked it quite a lot.
It's the Japanese animated film Weathering With You. It's rated PG-13, written and directed by Makoto Shinkai, and it's in select theaters starting Wednesday of this coming week, Wednesday, January 15th. Check your local listings. We have much more in the way of film criticism to come from Charles, Christy, and Tim. We'll hear about the movie Three Christs coming up, starring Richard Gere and Peter Dinklage. Also, 1917, which got top honors at the Golden Globes. It's getting a wider release this week. Our critics return to that. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, and I hope I get a chance to see you Monday. Our second hour of Air Talk will be live from our Crawford Family Forum. You can be in the audience for NPR's Steve Inskeep. The host of Morning Edition will be with me. We'll be talking about his new book on the Fremonts, the couple who had a huge role in the westward expansion of the United States, major figures here in California. But Steve will also talk with us about NPR's coverage of this election year and about the logistics of putting Morning Edition together in D.C. and in Los Angeles. Tickets are available. They're free. You can make your reservation at kpecc.org/in-person. And if you're not able to attend our live Air Talk 11 o'clock hour Monday morning at our Crawford Family Forum, tickets are still available for Steve's appearance with Writer's Block Monday evening in Santa Monica. You can even enter to win a complimentary pair of tickets to that event. Email events@kpecc.org, and there's more info at writersblockpresents.com. We continue. Our next film on Film Week is Three Christs, starring Richard Gere and Peter Dinklage, Walton Goggins, and Bradley Whitford in the cast as well. John Avnet directed the movie and co-wrote it with Eric Nazarian. Tim, what'd you think of Three Christs?
Interesting. This John Avnet, Fried Green Tomatoes, John Avnet. So this film is based on a study written by a psychiatrist named Milton Rokeach back in the 1950s, loosely based on a true story. The Three Christs of Ypsilanti is the name of that study. Here this character is played by Richard Gere, who in the 1950s goes to work at this state institution, where there are three men who all claim to be Jesus. God, Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth. They're very specific about who they are. His notion is to take these three men who have been declared paranoid schizophrenics. They pretty much declared everybody a paranoid schizophrenic back in 1955, if you were a little sideways. That's just the way that went. They were still doing electroshock therapy. They were still doing lobotomies. He was trying to move away from all of that and get into a different sort of talk therapy and analysis. And he took these three men and put them in the room to see what would happen if you had these three folks with this delusion, this specific delusion, in the room together. And to the extent that that's an interesting thing to do, this is an interesting movie.
So it sounds like a stage play, doesn't it?
It more or less small plays cast, that way.
Yeah. That was exactly what I was about to say. You read my mind, actually, because it does feel like a play in that so much of it takes place in this room where they're all just sitting side by side in these chairs in this very contained space. And all three of these actors, Walton Goggins and Bradley Whitford and Peter Dinklage, get such showy roles to work with here because, as Tim said, each incarnation of Jesus, or so they think they are, is so specific and so distinct. And so these are all tremendous longtime character actors who really get the chance to just, you know, sink their teeth into this meaty work. It's a great cast. It's quite gripping. Sometimes funny, unexpectedly so, but man, does it take a turn.
Mm.
It takes a turn from which it never recovers.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we need to see the things that we see or hear the things that we hear. Maybe that's what actually happened in real life. Yeah. I don't know. Well, but the way it's handled is really crass and jarring.
Yeah, this was a period when a lot of scientists were experimenting with LSD and all kinds of things like that. And I take it that this person who Gere is playing might have been involved in some of that kind of, you know, the Timothy Leary's and those types back then. A lot of that stuff comes into play. Juliana Margulies playing his wife in a, you know, sort of a thankless role.
I think she does the most that she can with it. There's not a lot on the page, but she's so lovely that she suggests an interior life on. But yeah, I'm mixed on it.
Yeah, there's that framing device where he's recording. The film starts, he's recording his experiences. And I'm like, what is the point of this framing device? I didn't get that at all.
I think because it's obvious that his face is a little bit cut up and he's a little bit weary. He's a little worn out from the experience. It like is building tension to suggest, okay, how did he get that way?
Yeah.
Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
Three Christ is the film. It's rated R. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center. 1917, fresh off of its Golden Globe's Best Dramatic Feature Film Award, is moving into wider release. It opened in L.A. on Christmas Day for Academy qualifying. The film is directed and co-written by Sam Mendes. It's rated R. Charles, you've had a chance to see 1917. Yeah. What'd you think?
I was surprised at how well I liked it because I recently saw the documentary about They Will Never Be Forgotten about World War I. And I thought, well, what can they add to that? And this feels absolutely authentic. When you look at the documentary, he's captured everything about life and existence, maybe in the trenches, very, very well. Very small cast, very simple, straightforward story, which I think makes it so affecting. You are there with this hapless British soldier who's been sent on a deadly, thankless mission to try and prevent more needless slaughter in World War I. And I was quite swept up by it. I mean, I think it's a little bit longer than it needs to be, which I think about a lot of movies these days. But again, after seeing that documentary that was so meticulous in its depiction of this life, I was completely swept up.
1917, Tim.
Yeah, the needlessness of the slaughter is an interesting thing in this movie. I wish it would have been more about the needlessness of the slaughter. But this is a heroic war movie. You know, yeah. These are heroes that we're watching. There's a device that Roger Deakins is using, that the filmmakers are using in this movie, where the film starts and we are in these long single takes, particularly as we travel through the trenches. And the film is meant to feel like that this is all happening in one complete. Now, it's not. There are cuts in ways that they do that. But you do get the sense that you're in this event.
Claustrophobic.
That just start happening. My main World War I movie is still going to be Paths of Glory, Kirk Douglas, Stanley Kubrick film. Because that film is about a man who does not want to go to war. They're refusing to fight. That's what I love most about that movie. This movie is about the thanklessness of the fight, but they still fight.
Christy?
It's an absolutely dazzling technical achievement. And over again, I'm watching it and thinking to myself, how did they get that shot? And, you know, it is long pieces of take. And Sam Mendes built like a mile of trench because they couldn't repeat themselves. You're following behind them and in front of them. And what it took to choreograph everything that is going around them is so mind-boggling. And they're walking like up and down through the trench and across in no man's land. And it's gloopy. I'm like, how is the camera still with them through water? Eventually, they get to a place where it looks like this nightmarish hellscape where the shadows from the lights from above, from the flares, are casting these like lurching fingertips of menace on this soldier. And it's just breathtaking to watch. Roger Deakins has totally outdone himself once again. Yes, it's also an emotional story, but it's hard not to watch it and just be dazzled from a technical perspective.
Mm. Yeah, and just as Christy was saying, from a visual perspective, the scenes of the burning, I guess it's a French town, are terrifying.
1917, from director and writer Sam Mendes. The film's rated R, and it's now in wide release. Just Mercy also has expanded into wide release. It opened for Academy qualification Christmas Day in Los Angeles. The film stars Michael B. Jordan as civil rights defense attorney Brian Stevenson. Jamie Foxx and Brie Larson co-star. Destin Daniel Cretton is the director and co-screenwriter. Christy?
This is very good, and it's very solid, and it could have been melodramatic and over the top. And what I really admire about the tone that Destin Daniel Cretton sets throughout is that, yes, you have these long speeches about the importance of justice. Michael B. Jordan has to give these long monologues in court, but it's understated, and so a truth always rings through. Michael B. Jordan plays a real-life gentleman named Brian Stevenson, who was a Harvard Law-educated lawyer who chooses to take that education and go down to the South to try to exonerate people who have wrongfully been placed on death row. And people are very skeptical of his ability to do that, but he is young, and he's ambitious, and he's dedicated to this. And one of the main people who he works with is Jamie Foxx's character, a gentleman who goes by the name Johnny D., who is wrongfully accused of killing an 18-year-old white woman at a dry cleaner's in small town Alabama. And it is, you know, kind of a solid and straightforward and traditional kind of courtroom drama, but everyone is tremendous in it. And it emotionally feels very, very true. And it could have been rather over the top and kind of cringy.
The issue here isn't whether or not Jamie Foxx's character, this real character, Walter McMillan, this man's name, is guilty. That's not a question. He is unequivocally and absolutely not guilty. The issue in the film is this system. The system that has decided that these things will work this way, what DAs do, what sheriffs do. There's another character, Tim Blake Nelson, who's just outstanding in this movie, and how the system has manipulated him into saying things that are not true, and how he wants redemption for that. We understand what's going to happen at the end of this film, so it's kudos that they're able to put that knot in your stomach anyway. Even though we know how this all turns out in the end. But it's the system that's on trial here in this movie more than anything else.
The film is Just Mercy. Again, it's expanding to wide release. Michael B. Jordan stars. Destin Daniel Cretton directed and wrote the screenplay with Andrew Lanham. It's rated PG-13. Also expanding into additional theaters this week, and with Amazon streaming coming later this year, is the French drama Les Misérables. The film is directed by Lodge Lee, who co-wrote the screenplay. Tim?
I love this movie. It's not a remake of Les Misérables. That's a title of the film. There is a reference there. The film takes place in the district where that was actually written. And it's interesting that when he was looking out of his window 150 years ago writing that, France was in revolution. People were dying in the streets. And here we fast forward 150 years, and where this film is set, France is in revolution. People are dying in the streets. And those two things being tied together are very interesting. This is a pretty straightforward thriller about this team of cops who do the things that they have to do to sort of maintain order in this sort of Arab and black quarter, French quarter. And all of the folks that they become involved with, a horrible thing happens, and they try to cover it up. All of these problems sort of come to bear. It's a very intense movie. It's incredibly violent. But it has these very interesting ideas that it's thinking about to go all the way back to some of the riots that were just 5 years ago in France in this very district in 2015.
This is a directorial debut for Lodge Lee. Christy?
It's amazing. Yeah, it's shot like a documentary. It has the immediacy and the understatement and straightforward nature of a documentary, and the way he regards all these characters and the intimacy that he achieves with them. There are these three different storylines that are all kind of on a collision course with each other. You have these cops who are patrolling the area. We are seeing it through the eyes of a corporal who is new to this precinct, who is, you know, seeing how intensely violent it is, and he is just shocked by it. So they're all on patrol. And then you have all these kids who were kind of wayward and growing up in the slums, and they don't seem to have much of a future, and they're all kind of like petty criminals, and then you have these Muslim gentlemen who are trying to, I don't know, are they trying to recruit the kids? Are they trying to just be a father figure to them? It's kind of a murky area. Mm. How would you interpret it, Tim?
Well, you know, it seems like they're trying to give them some sort of a structure, some sort of a family structure. But we know that very often these things lead to young Frenchmen being radicalized. But of course, these are young French boys. These boys were born in France, yet they're not treated like Frenchmen. And that therein lies the problem.
They are treated like criminals or like others. Yeah, and it's very, very intense. The ending, the long extended sequence at the end is very intense and very stressful. Extremely well done.
Les Miserables, the French drama, is the film. Lodge Lee, the director and co-screenwriter. It's rated R. You can see it at the ArcLight Hollywood, the Landmark in West L.A. And again, Amazon will stream the film later this year. We'll briefly touch on the crime drama Inherit the Viper, starring Josh Hartnett. Anthony Jergen is the director and Andrew Crabtree the screenwriter. Tim?
I like where this film is set, and I like what it's about. It's set in the sort of Appalachians area, present day, with these poor white folks dealing with the opioid crisis. We have this family, three members of this family. Josh Hartnett is a veteran back from the wars. He's got a younger brother who's not that sharp, and he's got this middle sister, and she is hardcore, and she's got the family selling these drugs. The younger brother wants to go out on his own. Josh wants to get out of all of this stuff. He's got a girlfriend who's pregnant. The brother tries to sell some drugs. It all goes bad. Look, this is not hell or high water good, but I like where it is. I like these people. We don't see movies about these people in these places struggling. Yeah. The way folks are today in the world.
I wish there had been more to it because the performances are so good, because the sense of place is so vivid. Margarita LaViva, who plays the middle sister, who is the oxy dealer in town, she's intense.
Oh, man.
But she gets to play lots of different shades of that, and we see vulnerability there for her, too. It's a really vivid sense of place. I kind of wish they had fleshed it out a bit more, because it has a story that needs to be told.
Mm. The movie is Inherit the Viper, starring Josh Hartnett, Margarita LaViva, and Owen Teague. It's rated R at the Arena Cine Lounge, Hollywood. For our Film Week critics, Larry Mantle with you. We're going to continue our conversation by focusing on actors and their political pronouncements. Ricky Gervais at the Golden Globes went after the actors for that. We'll talk about the response to his opening comments, that to come. We'll be back in just 2 minutes on Film Week. At the Golden Globes last Sunday, host comedian Ricky Gervais wasted no time taking aim at hypocrisy in Hollywood. He was wrapping up his opening monologue at the Globes and implored the winners to keep their acceptance speeches short. In this excerpt, you're going to hear a bit of a gap where NBC actually removed some of the profanity in it, but you get the sense.
Well, you say you're woke, but the companies you work for, I mean, unbelievable. Apple, Amazon, Disney. If ISIS started a streaming service, you'd call your agent, wouldn't you? So, if you do win an award tonight, don't use it as a platform to make a political speech, right? You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg. So, if you win, right, come up, accept your little award, thank your agent and your God, and... So... It's already 3 hours long.
So Gervais, and this was not greeted well in the audience because, of course, actors love getting up and opining about politics. That's kind of part of what it is to be an actor these days, is to get up and to do that. And they're invited to speak about politics at different events. It's become not only accepted, but broadly encouraged in Hollywood. My question for you as an Air Talk listener is, do you applaud Gervais for his comments that people are perhaps more interested in seeing actors and celebrities doing things that are a result of their views and making contributions? Or do you like hearing them talk about it? We're at 866-893-KPCC. And do you think it furthers the causes that actors and other celebrities support? Or do you think that there's a net deficit when they get up and opine on particular topics? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With me is senior editor at Deadline, Dominic Patton. Dominic, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry.
You're in New York for covering Harvey Weinstein's criminal trial. But on the issue of the Golden Globes, you haven't been shy about being critical of Ricky Gervais. But what did you think about this particularly pointed criticism?
Well, I actually think that Ricky, you know, and I'm a huge fan of Ricky Gervais. I thought Ricky kind of, on his fifth time at the Golden Globes, kind of became the Jeb Bush of this, very low energy. His point here, though, is not one that I think should be lost on people, especially now as we're ending, you know, what could be the first and only term of Donald Trump. Hollywood has been very political the past several years, to the point when people show up at an award show and don't opine, to paraphrase you, we're actually surprised. The thing is, I'm not entirely sure that it's doing either the causes or the celebrities any favors, because I think ultimately, in politics, like anything in life, credibility and hard work is what people pay into. So I'm not sure if it's working for them. Then again, and I think Ricky pointed this out, everything Ricky Gervais said could have been said to the current president of the United States and former Celebrity Apprentice host, who seems to opine about everything, whether or not he knows anything about it or not.
But he suffered a great deal of cost to doing that in terms of public support as well. But and actors rely on the support of a mixed political audience who go to their films. And the other thing I wonder about, to me, I really do pay attention when celebrities are out there doing different things, have their charities are out doing charitable work. I notice because I like that. I think it's really great when people that are in the public eye are doing things that are an expression of their values. I don't tend to pay a lot of attention when they're just up opining because usually they're just sort of statements and not particularly analytical. They're not too much to go with. They're just sort of saying, this is how I think about this thing. And I wonder if do actors get any sorts of pressure beyond their peers on this from studios, from agents or anything, or they've kind of left to their own devices on this?
Well, I think it's a combination. I mean, I think it depends on what they're up for and what they're talking about. I mean, I think if you're getting an award or giving an award for a socially aware or socially commentating film, I think you kind of want to appear like, you know, it's kind of like people who wear glasses in public life who don't need to. You want to appear kind of smart. But I will also say this, too. I think that, again, I come back to my major point, which I think is credibility. I'll give you an example because it happened today. Jane Fonda, for the past several Fridays, has been conducting these protests in Washington, D.C., looking at climate change and global warming. She has an actress who's literally put herself on the line, whether or not you agree with her politics or not, for decades and decades, has continued to do it again. Today, we saw Joaquin Phoenix, who obviously was a big winner at the Golden Globes for The Joker, talked about environmental effects, talked about how he liked that they were eating vegan food at the Golden Globes, got a lot of mocking from people. Joaquin showed up. Joaquin got arrested today in Washington, D.C., as did Martin Sheen, a.k.a. former President Bartlett, a.k.a. Jane Fonda's co-star on Netflix, Grace and Frankie. You know, those are three individuals, to varying degrees, who have put their politics where their mouth is and have put their mouth where their politics are and are stepping up for the issues they believe in very strongly. Jane Fonda herself, obviously, to many things.
Yeah, and it's great they're getting arrested for what they believe in. I think we can all respect that. But I'm really interested to know, well, what size house do they live in? And how much air travel do they do? And what is their carbon footprint? You know, I'm interested
they
how
drive?
They live. Yeah, I'm interested a lot more in how they live than getting arrested at the protest or what they have to say about global warming. And so, you know, I think of Ed Begley Jr., Dominic, who, talk about a guy who lived environmentalism, he would be demonstrating how his, you know, his electric car, he's one of the first people with him, the house that he lived in, and he was one of the first to talk about composting and all this stuff. Ed Begley Jr. lived all this environmental stuff, and I found that a lot more interesting.
I agree, but then again, I would say some of the criticisms you made at the beginning there, or potential criticisms, were the very same thing that a lot of the right wing would say about former Vice President Al Gore when he first started talking about global warming a long time before a lot of other people. They'd say, well, that's very easy for you to talk about. You've just been flown around on Air Force Two for the past 8 years, and that's a huge carbon footprint. I think that this is also one of the debates we get into about celebrities, because what ultimately they're doing is they're using a heightened platform that people like me and you provide to them through the media and the spotlight of that to talk about issues that are important to them. Is the balance of where they're, what they're trying to promote, is, does that have to be weighed by what they do in their personal life, or vice versa?
Why wouldn't you, though, Dominic? If you, isn't that the reality check? Is if it's important enough to change the way they live there? And Al Gore flying on Air Force Two, that's a different thing. He's vice president, and that's different. We're talking about these other day-to-day ways that people live. We're not talking about, do they not go on publicity tours that they need to do for their work.
I agree, but like, for instance, Joaquin Phoenix has said that he is probably going to wear the same tuxedo to all the award shows this award season. And Joaquin's going to be showing up at all of them because he's a major contender. He's already received derision for that. He's already had people saying, oh my God, his dry cleaner will probably cause more environmental damage than if he was driving a Hummer and that kind of thing. So I do feel, and look, I'm scathing about these situations. I think a lot of people don't know what they're talking about. I'm right in the ballpark with Ricky, even though I wasn't a big fan of this recent stint hosting the Golden Globes. But I think most of these people don't know what they're talking about. But I also am a big believer that, you know, when people are trying to talk about important issues, even if they are just trying to move the ball a little bit, we tell far too much about ourselves by mocking them about equally as petty issues as the ones that we would choose to bring them down upon. I think a lot of celebrities are kind of harmless in their belief. A lot of them are kind of nice. I mean, there's a graduation. There's a difference between writers and directors and actors for obvious reasons. And I think more than anything, the more voices we have in political debate at any era, be it the Trump era, the Obama era, the Clinton era, what have you, that's what democracy is about.
Well, and hopefully no one's talking about silencing people from sharing their perspectives and their deeply held views. We're talking with Dominic Patton, senior editor at Deadline. Topher in Costa Mesa says, I spent many years working in security for a Los Angeles firm, high-profile clients, and I spent a lot of time with people who were in that audience. And I can tell you, many of them are hypocrites in just the way that Ricky Gervais described them. That's Topher in Costa Mesa. Harriet in Tarzana says, just because you're a good actor doesn't mean you have a sense of what's really going on in the world, and your opinion doesn't carry more weight than anyone else. That's Harriet in Tarzana. I want to hear what our Film Week critics have to say about this, and our Film Week listeners at 866-893-KPCC. Back in a minute. Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about actors and other celebrities who make political pronouncements, particularly at award shows. Ricky Gervais, in his opening monologue, went after the actors in the room, calling them hypocrites, essentially saying they'd take work wherever it came from, even if it was ISIS-related, exaggerating to make his point that often the people in the room didn't really firmly stand behind what they said that they did, and that much of it was political posturing. My question for you is, well, what do you think of that? And do you think it's valuable for the causes that actors support for them to do public opining at major events like this? 866-893-KPCC. That's for those of you listening to the live Friday, 11 o'clock airing of Film Week. Christy, let me start with you on this one. Do you think that it does help the causes for actors to do this?
I think a fatigue sets in. I completely understand the instinct and the drive when you reach a certain level of celebrity to use that for the greater good or for the causes that you think are significant, whether it be climate change or, you know, certain political candidates that you're in support of. I totally see why they feel like they need to. And, you know, actors are talent. They think that what they have to say is very, very important. I understand that. But I can understand how, in the greater sense, when you hear that over and over again, that it becomes noise. It becomes like a deafening noise. As for what Ricky Gervais said during the Golden Globes, I suspect that was just him, you know, doing shtick. As Dominic pointed out, this is his fifth year in a row of doing it, or fifth year total of doing it. And it just sort of felt all kind of like been there, done that, phoning it in. And that was part of the shtick, too. Like, yeah, whatever. Got my beer in my hand. I guess I got to get through this. So I'm not sure how much he felt strongly about the things he was saying himself beyond just trying to be provocative in the moment on live TV before international audience.
And why do you invite Ricky Gervais if you don't want him to make people angry?
Yeah, Tim, what do you think?
Intention goes a long way for me, generally speaking. Good intention goes a very, very long way for me. I cover a lot of red carpets in this town, do a lot of charity events. I cannot tell you how many times I've been talking to someone across a velvet rope that had no idea what charity they were there in support of. And how you have to sort of like make your way around that. But, you know, there they are. A lot of it has to do with what kind of skin gets put in the game. We mentioned Martin Sheen. Martin Sheen, back in the 80s, would get arrested trying to stop nuclear power plants from being built. So he was there physically doing this and has been. There's even a commercial spot running now that has him.
That plays with that history
that
of
whole
him
history
being
of
a protester.
Being this guy, Sean Penn. Sean Penn, for years and years and years, you know, I'd run into Sean Penn quite a lot, lived in a trailer in Malibu. Well, after he was a big, big, big movie star, lived in that trailer in Malibu, when Katrina hit New Orleans, Sean Penn was not so much talking at award shows because he was in New Orleans building houses.
And that gets a lot less attention, that kind of out there, you know, doing real work on behalf of these causes.
And Sean gets poked a lot for some of his sort of activism, but I can't poke him when I see him down there, when, you know, nailing hammers in with Jimmy Carter. Kevin Costner, when that Gulf oil thing happened, Kevin Costner spent $20 million of his own money to try to stop that oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. A lot of people don't know that. So, you know, I don't think that we should poke these people quite as hard as we want to. Some of them really lean hard and deep into the thing that they are in support of.
One of the things that I think is particularly valuable is when actors who have a public profile because of their excellence or public social media following or whatever it is, address issues within the industry itself, whether that has to do with hiring practices, the kinds of films that get made. That, to me, is where there's great gravitas because they know the business. And often people who don't have the economic means in the actual working their way up, they can't take that kind of a public position. And to me, that, Christy, is very valuable.
Right. When Frances McDormand said the words
she came first to
mind. Inclusion rider is a phrase that probably the vast majority of us had never heard before. And now I believe that films are coming out with the use of the inclusion rider, and that became, you know, a catchphrase for several weeks afterward. Both Michelle Williams and Patricia Arquette used their platform on Sunday night to make industry-related statements. And is that preaching to the choir? Perhaps, but folks are watching at home too, and maybe they will be informed about a topic that they hadn't given much thought to previously.
Now, I come down with Tim on the how much skin do they have in the game. Similarly, Hayao Miyazaki was arrested as a student for protesting nukes in Japan and he's not only made films that have ecological themes, he works with his neighborhood association to clean the stream near where they live, and fishing the junk out of it gave him the idea for the stink god in Spirited Away. Similarly, someone I think is truly admirable in this sense is the Canadians with the National Film Board of Canada. They recently completed a program where now 50% of all the NFB films and 50% of the funding goes to work by women. And they have a similar program to include a proportional number of Native peoples. So when you actually are doing something, I think you have a credibility that if you just like a flashy idea, you don't have.
Let's talk with Tammy in Sherman Oaks. I understand you're work with nonprofits, connecting Hollywood talent with nonprofits.
Well, I'm a casting director, and in my non-professional life, I work with a lot of nonprofits and help them to raise their visibility or amplify their message by connecting them to celebrities that, you know, get a lot of attention. And one of the things that I found important is that sometimes the celebrities don't know. They're not experts about the issues. However, they are eager to learn, and they are committed to using their celebrity to really amplify those messages. And it can be incredibly helpful for organizations to get that kind of attention.
Oh, yeah, because the kind of public attention having a celebrity attached to a cause is, I'm sure, huge. Tammy, I appreciate it. What do you do to help the talent you work with get up to speed on the cause?
Well, the organizations are usually pretty happy to share information. So we give them bullet points if they want to take a meeting with the executive directors of the organizations and learn more, or take a tour of if it's a place of business. And we find that the celebrities want to be educated. You know, they want to know what they're talking about when they're out there in front of a camera or a microphone.
Tammy, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Bob in Santa Monica says, what does it matter if they're hypocrites? If what they're saying is true, Bob, I appreciate it. I think the problem is if you have someone who's standing up in front of an audience talking about the importance of equity in film and representation, and you know that in their hiring practices, the way they conduct their business, that they're acting in a discriminatory way, I think that undermines the message. It would be much better to have people working on equity and justice in the work that they're actually doing and not talking about it than talking about the importance of justice and behaving in an unjust way. Chris in Manhattan Beach says, entertainers' jobs are to illuminate the human condition. I don't want to hear them thank their agents. It's much more interesting to hear them talk about issues. That's Chris in Manhattan Beach. And John posts on the Air Talk Facebook page, I think it's okay if what actors are saying is germane to the film or to the role that they're getting an award for. No matter what, they need to be respectful of others and stick to the allotted time. That's John on the Facebook page. All right, thanks so much for joining us to talk about this issue. We appreciate Dominic Patton, senior editor at Deadline, joining us from New York, where he's there to cover the Harvey Weinstein trial. And also our thanks to Tim Cogshell, Christy Lemire, and Charles Solomon, our critics this week. And I hope you'll join all the critics and me for our 18th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview, Sunday morning, February 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.